Please stay tuned to the end of this program or see the show notes for important information regarding today's speakers and the content of this podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Allergy Talk, a roundup of the latest in the field of allergy and immunology by the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. For today's episode, we'll be reviewing another recent article issue of Allergy Watch, a bi-monthly publication, which provides research summaries to college members from the major journals in allergy and immunology. And you can also earn CME credit by listening to this podcast. For information about CME or to read archived issues of Allergy Watch, head over to college.acaai.org/publications/AllergyWatch. And we'll also create a post on Doc Matter where we can discuss these articles we present today. Well, hello, everyone. My name is Jerry Lee. I'm an associate professor at Emory University and an assistant editor of Allergy Watch. Today, once again, I'm joined by the editor-in-chief of Allergy Watch, Dr. Stan Feinman.
Hi, everybody. Yeah, it's good to be here. I'm also in private practice at Atlanta Allergy and an adjunct faculty at Emory.
And for the third chair, we're once again joined by Dr. Samantha Knox, an assistant editor at Allergy Watch. Thanks for coming back.
Hi, thanks for having me again. I'm a pediatric allergist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse, Wisconsin. I also serve as a clinical adjunct assistant professor for the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health.
Great. So we have three more really cool articles to go over. Stan, why don't you start off about immunotherapy?
So this was an article that was published in the European Respiratory Journal and was reviewed by Brad Chips, and it's entitled Allergen Immunotherapy Effectively Reduces the Risk of Exacerbations in Lower Respiratory Tract Infections in Both Seasonal and Perennial Allergic Asthma. This was a nationwide epidemiologic study. The first author is Wolick, and it is from Denmark. We've talked about the fact that Denmark has a national health system, and they've got records on all kinds of things, and that's where these authors got their data. It's a prospective register-based national study of 18 to 44-year-olds who were treated with allergen immunotherapy 1995 through 2014. So it was a long period of time that they got the data from. And, you know, based on the type of the immunotherapy and the use of various anti-asthmatic drugs, the patients were divided into two groups, the perennial allergic asthma. Those are the ones who just had dust mite antigens in their formula, and seasonal allergic asthma, which had pollens, and they might have had dust mites as well. And then they looked at data on the use of antibiotics against lower respiratory tract infections or steroids or oral corticosteroids for exacerbations. And then they analyzed them basically to see how they did while they were on their immunotherapy, starting the immunotherapy at baseline, and then after 3 years, they measured it. They looked at it after 3 years. So they did figured a three-year period of immunotherapy. And the analysis really looked at 2,688 adults. Again, I told you they were adults. They were 18 to 44 years of age. And the mean age was 32. And as I mentioned, they did base it on the medication use and the formula for the immunotherapy. About 1,400 of the patients had the seasonal allergic asthma and 1,200 had the perennial allergic asthma. And then, of course, they used it, looked at the antibiotic use. So at baseline, the exacerbation rate was 23.8% in patients with the seasonal allergic asthma. And it was lower, it was 16.5% in the perennial allergic asthma. So more of the patients with seasonal, more allergens, they had a higher exacerbation rate. The rate of the respiratory tract infections, lower respiratory tract infections, was 38% and 37%. So that was pretty even for both perennial or seasonal allergic asthma. Over the 3 years of immunotherapy, so after the 3 years, the exacerbation rate decreased by 74% in the seasonal allergic asthma group and by 56% in the perennial allergic asthma group. And the reductions in the infection rate, I mean, that's really dramatic. The reductions in the infection rate were 20% and 17% respectively. So not as dramatic, but still, I think, very remarkable. And of course, this kind of reflects what we see in our practices. The exacerbations relating to infections decreased after the immunotherapy with the seasonal, but not so much statistically with the perennial allergic asthmatics. So the prospective follow-up study showed a reduced rate of exacerbations and lower respiratory infections 3 years after the allergen immunotherapy in these young adults with the seasonal or perennial allergic asthma. The findings do not support the hypothesis that perennial allergic asthma is a stronger risk for impaired immune defenses compared to seasonal allergic asthma, because the infection rate was pretty similar. And the researchers conclude that allergen immunotherapy is a potentially promising early add-on therapy for patients with exacerbation and respiratory infection tendencies. And Dr. Chips, in his comments, felt that the data provides more ammunition to protect. Really, allergen immunotherapy is an important adjunct to care for our own patients. And this, of course, is kind of what we see. And the other comment I'd like to say is that we've seen the guidelines for asthma expand to add allergen immunotherapy as a potential treatment for allergic asthma, moderate persistent, mild persistent, moderate persistent type asthmatics. And I think we just need to show everybody this is just another study showing the benefit of allergen immunotherapy in our allergic asthmatics.
Yeah, Stan, thanks for bringing this article up. I really understand that people are just going to see an asthmatic, throw medicine at it, and call it a day. And certainly, you can treat asthma like that. But only the allergist immunologist, in my opinion, really, really emphasize the whole patient with asthma. And that's exposure and also the role of modifying the disease. I mean, it is amazing how many patients with asthma didn't even know that immunotherapy exists. No one has ever told them that treatment exists. And I'm not saying every patient qualifies for immunotherapy, but people should be able to be empowered to make choices about their care. And maybe they want to do a therapy that potentially will get to the underlying root of their symptoms and reduces, again, as you're stating, their susceptibility to exacerbations other than more medicine. Because, you know, as you know, immunotherapy is not intended to be, you know, a lifelong therapy. In fact, we're trying to get people on less medicine. That's what we're trying to do. So I think this is just further evidence that when we make our talking points with our providers, that they should be aware that offering choices to their patients is going to provide just other benefits just than treating the allergies. There's other effects that are not considered, and certainly less seasonal exacerbations to viral infection clearly is going to be a benefit here.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. I think the shared decision-making and knowing all of your options, because I've had that same experience where people just don't know what that involves, what that entails, and makes them think a little bit. And we've gotten to that point of having those discussions and did end up doing immunotherapy after they had a little bit more of the idea of what it actually is and going through. But the interesting thing about this study is that it does, even though it's not an incredible percentage, it still does decrease the exacerbations. And as we're going back to, you know, the other episode talking about oral corticosteroid use and reducing the use of those medications, we know that just a small amount could really affect long-term bone health, adrenal health, just in the longevity of it. This is something that is helping you kind of in that future for the long term. So if it can do something for them, I think they really need to know this option because it truly can be effective.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So again, that previous episode talking about exacerbations and comorbidities, even with low one or two exacerbations with steroid courses under 500 milligrams. Yes, I think those two articles really complement each other. So definitely check out the previous episode where we discussed that. So Sam, I think you had an interesting article about the baked food tolerant child. So tell us about the study.
Yeah, so this is a study out of the Annals of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, and it is titled Prospective Evaluation of Tolerance to Unheated Milk Boiled Egg After Baked Milk Egg Tolerance Under 2 Years. That is a mouthful, but what they're basically looking at is those patients that are egg and milk allergic and when they can tolerate baked products and then ultimately tolerate the unheated or regular form. And they're looking specifically at this population under 2 years. So this is a Turkish study done at the pediatric allergy clinics of Kosali University Medical Faculty in Turkey. And they included the kids under age 2 with confirmed IgE-mediated cow's milk and egg allergy. So confirmed, that's really important. So not just like questionnaire-based or reported-based. This is confirmed with skin or serum testing and oral food challenges for unheated milk and regular egg. And we know already in prior studies, within allergy, if you treat children and you do a bit with food allergy, we know that there have been prior studies showing that baked egg and baked milk products are generally tolerated in anywhere from 70 to 80% of kids who have regular egg and unheated milk allergies. But a lot of the studies have looked at kids outside of the age of 2 years. So what they're trying to look at is, are they able to tolerate and what's the time to tolerating? So basically, tolerance rate of baked products at different time points in the first 2 years of life, the time between acquiring tolerance to unheated, a regular egg after tolerance of the respective baked product, how many went on to achieve tolerance, and then, you know, looking at predictors of tolerance to baked products. So it was a small study, only a total of like 101 patients. They had to exclude some because they didn't really follow up. So they did a good job at just kind of following those that they could that did go through the full 2 years. But they did baked egg and baked milk muffin challenges. And those who were tolerant were advised to incorporate into the diet regularly and offered unheated milk or regular egg challenges at 3 month intervals. So a lot of us in practice end up doing it at every 6 or considering it at 1 year, but they did it offering it pretty regularly earlier, even if there was an accidental exposure and they tolerated it. And then those were followed for a year. The ones that were reactive to the baked products or had reacted to breast milk after mom had eaten one of the egg or milk, then were followed for the first 2 years of life and offered baked challenges every 3 months. So they looked at a number of different skin symptoms. So we know positive challenges were anything from skin reactions to GI, respiratory, and anaphylaxis. They did actually include eczema flares too. So that's important that the eczema flare within 6 hours with a SCORAD score of above 10 or more and resolved with food elimination considered to be positive. This population, no surprise to everyone, had high rates of atopic dermatitis. So 70% of them in milk and 80% of the egg allergic patients. So in general, what they found, they had 36 milk allergic and 65 egg allergic patients. And if you are going back to the study, looking at figures 1 and 2 will help kind of sort a lot of these little statistics out to look at kind of the flow. It's a lot easier if you're a visual learner like me, looking at that was a lot easier for me to look at than read. But overall, about a third of the milk allergic patients were initially baked milk tolerant with a median age of about 8 months. So pretty young patients they looked at here. And then an additional 16 patients achieved baked milk tolerance by age 21 months. So about 80% of the milk allergic patients were baked milk tolerant by 2 years old. And then just over half of those that were initially tolerant achieved the milk tolerance, unheated milk tolerance, around a median age of 14 months. And that was about 4 months after baked milk tolerance. So again, they had majority of the kids were baked milk tolerant by age 2, and those that achieved tolerance in there took about maybe 4 months. So by somewhere around 14 months, kind of in median age. And then about 75% of the kids went on to achieve baked milk tolerance, just kind of who achieved baked milk tolerance later went on to achieve unheated milk tolerance by age 2. And that took about 5 months or so in general. But what they found with milk is that, not surprisingly, those who were baked milk tolerant initially were basically achieved milk, unheated milk tolerance a lot earlier than those who were baked milk reactive initially. And that was 14 months for the baked milk tolerant versus almost 24 months for the baked milk reactive initially. So we're looking at about 10 months difference. And when you think about the other studies, there have been some that have suggested that getting it incorporated into the diet may help reduce that time to tolerating the regular form. And the same goes for egg. Nearly half of them were baked egg tolerant, and that was around median age of 10 months. And about 3/4 of the patients initially baked egg tolerant achieved regular egg tolerance by a median age of about 14 months. And that only took, there was a 3 month difference between baked egg tolerance and regular egg tolerance. And again, those who had baked milk or baked egg tolerance initially had an earlier rate of tolerance to the regular form of egg, 14 months versus 23 months. So kind of a similar picture to milk. we did see some anaphylaxis in some of those challenges, but a good portion of those patients did go on to at least tolerate like a baked form. Some of them were still reactive. I think what they mentioned here were that children who were allergic to baked egg at baseline were 3 times more likely than those who were tolerant to have persistent egg allergy, and that boys were 5 times more likely than girls to be initially reactive to baked milk, and patients with multiple food allergies were about 5 times more likely than those with egg allergy to be initially reactive to baked egg. There is a lot of issue here, I think, with if you have larger skin test, higher specific IgE level, a more severe reaction at the beginning. If you are not baked egg or milk tolerant initially, there may be a much higher chance for you to be persistent. And I think that correlates with what we're seeing clinically and in some of the other studies. But this is interesting because these are two very ubiquitous foods. So in my experience, the parents want to get those foods back in. Milk and egg are hard to eliminate in a regular diet and keep them out of the diet. This study showed a majority of the population was able to tolerate baked milk and baked egg early on in infancy, and a good portion achieving it by age 2 years. We do have to take into account that the majority of initial reactions were eczema flares, but a good portion of them that reacted during the challenge to milk or egg still had urticaria. There were some eczema flares in there, but they were urticarial, kind of looking like systemic reactions. I think if we had a different population where there was more severe reactions at the beginning or, you know, much, much higher levels and bigger populations in the study, we might see some different numbers. But it really begs the question about when to try baked products in an egg or milk allergic patient. How do you get those into an infant? Do you crumble up, you know, the baked milk muffin, put it into a puree, get that in? How much is okay and how often? So, you know, there's a lot of people that may wait 6 to 12 months, wait until they can eat a full muffin and they're 18 months, 24 months. But there may be some ways to really kind of get that in earlier and potentially accelerate the process.
Yeah, you know, we struggle with this, especially in these young kids. I find that trying to do a challenge in them is really hard. They can't tell you that their tummy hurts. But one of the problems I had with the study, the fact that it was, number one, a very small number of kids, and number two, it wasn't clear to me how they made the diagnosis of the milk or the egg allergy. I mean, I always talk to moms about the risk for anaphylaxis and whether or not, you know, if the child has a eczema and maybe a small type reaction, but never had like anaphylaxis, I'm going to be a little more aggressive about using like a baked food in the diet, maybe do a challenge there. But I find that it's very hard to do. It's a very hard diagnosis sometimes, but I'm glad to see this kind of data. I think it's reassuring for us in the clinic that we can try to push the baked foods in some of these children.
I want to echo a couple of comments that you made. The first one, getting the kid to eat the darn thing during the challenge. I think I'm glad you brought that up. I think I struggle. We've been using like Little Mix-Ins, baked egg and the baked milk. You're right. I'm not aware of an easy to eat product. I guess you, as you're suggesting, try to break it down in something a toddler could eat if they're going to eat it. That's challenging. But again, the other thing that really confounds this is the initial diagnosis. I agree with you. I mean, if someone just says they have an eczema flare after milk or egg, I'm pretty aggressive. I probably would, if the testing looks okay, I would go directly to milk or egg. And, you know, I'm not saying that an eczema flare isn't bothersome to the family. But again, I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to potentially introduce it early enough to prevent it converting into a more serious allergic reaction. And especially if we can, if eczema is treatable with skincare, that sort of thing. You know, we do that all the time to treat eczema to get the food into the kid, you know? So yeah, I think it's just hard to interpret these things. Certainly when someone passes a milk or egg challenge after baked 3 or 4 months after that, you wonder what they're allergic to begin with. That's really my point.
I agree with that. And one of the things that I often discuss when I'm going through just atopic dermatitis management is the role of allergens. So we go through the role of environmental allergens, but the role of food allergens and what that means. If you look back to the study, I'm blanking on where it was, but it was 2016 maybe, where they looked at the food-induced atopic dermatitis and those kids that had those prolonged avoidance of something after being sensitized, but only eczema flares. The ones that went on to react later, 20% of them had anaphylaxis. So we may be doing more of a disservice here and creating more of an issue by avoiding them initially. So making that diagnosis right away. And we do have challenges there to kind of confirm that and decide where do we go from there? So that's the biggest thing, is making that initial diagnosis. So that's why I said with a small population here, and if we had those kids that were reacting more systemically, what would these numbers actually look like? What would that, you know, the trajectory? And I think that's why a lot of the studies incorporate much older kids, because those are the ones that have a little bit more persistent.
Sure, absolutely. But I think baked milk or egg certainly is going to be lower risk and is going to open things up earlier. I think some parents are gun shy. So I think there is a role for shared decision making. But I do like the fact that we're going to try to, again, not wait forever to re-explore regular non-baked milk or egg. So I do agree with at least exploring that after we've established they're baked food tolerant. So great discussion. I think that was very helpful. I got one more article to go over, and this is like a small one, but I just opened up something that I thought was very interesting. So this is coming out of Mount Sinai. This is published in JACI. It's called Multiscale Study of the Oral and Gut Environments in Children with High and Low Threshold Peanut Allergy. So they have 59 children here who are being enrolled in a study called Cafeteria, Challenging to Food with Escalating Thresholds for Reduced Food Allergy. So all of them are undergoing double-blind placebo-controlled food challenges where they were able to split the group into high threshold and low threshold. So obviously they're doing graded food challenges. And so they have this definition that if you basically are able to tolerate the 300 milligram dose, so you were able to eat a cumulative dose of 443, you're considered high threshold. So you reacted, but you reacted above 300. And then there's low threshold, means you reacted under at the 300 dose or less. So what they did as part of the study is they got microbiome data. So they got saliva from the children, they got stool from the children, and then they looked at short-chain fatty acids. And interestingly, when they analyzed oral and stool microbiomes and underwent statistical analysis, they found different thresholds. They found differences in diversity. I am horrible at pronouncing bacterial names, right? But there's this species in the saliva, Veillonella nakazawe, that was more abundant in the high threshold group than the low threshold group. And then they looked at gut bacteria. So there was this other gut bacterium that was more abundant in the low threshold children, Bacteroides theta iota omicron. And also they looked at differences in the short-term fatty acids associated with these species. And they were able to find association between that V. nakazawe and odor butyrate. And this sort of raises two things. Number one, if there is differences in the microbiome between high and low threshold, the first thing is that could just be obviously suggesting something about the influence of microbiome in developing tolerance. But then it raises the provocative hypothesis that intervention in microbiome affects food allergy threshold. Now, where would you pull this out of? Well, I was thinking about the PPOIT study, right? Where they did probiotic supplementation for peanut oral immunotherapy. And although that study, you know, in a phase 3 methodology did not find improved efficacy, it actually had better safety, right? So you had a better safety if you gave probiotics in the context of oral immunotherapy. So you wonder, and again, this is just very theoretical, that if we were able to manipulate the microbiome, I mean, the low-hanging fruit that's already been demonstrated in that study is that we can make immuno-OIT safer. But then if people want one by protection, could the microbiome manipulation in itself get someone to a place to get that peace of mind? Because that's what we're exploring with the patch. We're exploring it with biologics now. And so you wonder if manipulation of the microbiome, could you get to that endpoint? Again, very preliminary study. I just thought it was a very provocative question that he answered. And I think it was worth discussing.
I don't think it would hurt. I mean, probiotics, looking at all of that, the microbiome, the skin, the gut microbiomes have been so dynamic. And that manipulation, what could hurt adding in something like the probiotic? And safety is the biggest thing. That's the main reason why we have to look at various forms of immunotherapy, because what does the patient want to know? is this going to help me? But also, am I going to be safe doing this? And so if we can explore some of those options, think outside the box, we already know that the microbiome is a part of us. In allergy and immunology, the microbiome is largely a part of us. So I think thinking outside the box and having that discussion about using the probiotics and making something a safer option for patients is certainly worth it.
Yeah, I mean, the comment that I would make on this article is that we do have a lot to learn about the use of probiotics. And I do use probiotics for some of the patients when I give them antibiotics, but I don't routinely recommend them for, you know, food allergy, or even when they're on oral immunotherapy for peanut allergy. So I'm glad to see these types of studies and look forward to some more guidance on, you know, how best to help our patients with this.
Yeah, I like Sam's point about safety, right? If we talk about OIT or we're talking about biologics, as far as I know, probiotics are safer and they're cheaper. Now, the question is, do they work? I think that's what we have to wait for. So I think our patients would prefer something safer and not like thousands of dollars. So let's hopefully move in that direction. Well, anyways, I hope you enjoyed the discussion. These are really interesting articles and thought-provoking. If you have further thoughts to contribute, again, watch out for that Doc Matter post, or again, email us directly. Our email is allergytalk@acaai.org. And remember, if you want to earn CME credit for listening to this podcast, just go to our website. It's college.acaai.org/publications/allergywatch. Well, this is Jerry Lee signing off for this episode of Allergy Talk. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the rest of your day. ACAAI is presenting this podcast for educational purposes only. It is not medical advice, nor is it intended to replace the judgment of a licensed physician. The college is not responsible for any claims related to the procedures, professionals, products, or methods discussed in the podcast, and it does not approve or endorse any products, professionals, services, or methods that might be referenced. Today's speakers have the following disclosures. Drs. Lee and Knox have nothing to disclose, and Dr. Feynman has been a speaker for Takeda and has done research for AIMmune, DBV, and BioCryst.